This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadan ashraf al-anbiya'i wal-mursaleen wa alihi wa sahabati wa man tibi'ahum bi ihsanan ila yawm al-din. Allahumma allimna ma yanfa'una wa yanfa'una bima allamtana wa zidna ilma. Rabbi yassir li amri wa shrah li sadri wa hlul 'uqdatan min lisani yafqahu qawli. Inshallah, this is a quick overview of what's known as al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya, which is beneficial in terms of studying fiqh or the law in order to understand what the intentions behind the law are. So the first thing that should be understood is, although unlike the Mu'tazila, who were the rationalists, we do not believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that He has to benefit His creation. The Mu'tazila said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that what He did had to be for the benefit of His creation. It was a wajib for Allah. Whereas we don't say that. Allah does it out of His bounty, not out of any obligation. So the first thing to know is that the Sharia and the Usuliyun, or the people of these roots, say that all of the sacred dispensations from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to the human are based on the preservation of five matters. All. So every Sharia that was given to the human being was in order to protect five things. The first of which is deen itself. Because the human being is a homo religiosus, he is a religious creature by nature. The human being is a religious creature by nature. Human beings will act out ritual in every culture. This is something anthropologists recognize. Anybody who studies human societies recognize that every society has rituals. Yet, are those rituals from the human being himself, or are they derived from revelation? This is the difference between the Muslim and the rest of societies. And I'm saying Muslim here in the ideal sense, because many Muslims around the world have fallen into ritual that is not from Allah, and Allah gave them no authority to do that. Many, many examples we could use from the Muslim world for those things. Now, some of them would go under what's known as urf, or customary practice. But others are clearly against the teaching of Islam. For instance, the female giving a dowry in a wedding. You will find that in some Muslim countries where the female is forced to give a dowry because of previous religious traditions that were strong in those cultures. And yet that is against Islam. So that's an example of tradition becoming part of a jahiliyyah or an ignorance within the culture. So Islam is not against the customs of a people. Islam honors people. Where it goes, Islam acts as a sieve. It doesn't say everybody has to become Arab. Right, like for instance, and I happen to be wearing a Moroccan dress. I'm not a Moroccan. I don't have to wear this dress. There's nothing in my deen that tells me I have to wear this dress. Right? Nothing. There's nothing in my deen that says I have to wear a turban. Now, this is not even Sunnah dress, really. This robe, the type they wear in North Africa, is not from the Sunnah. The turban is Sunnah of Adat. And some say Sunnah of fada'il, that it's a virtuous thing, because it's virtuous to bury a person with a turban. So many of the scholars have said it is a sunnah of fada'il, because there are weak hadith that indicate that it's a good thing to wear a turban. But there's nothing in Sharia that in order to be a Muslim you have to wear a turban. And if you don't wear a turban, you're not a good Muslim. Nothing says that. It's encouraged to cover the head. It's mandub. Cover the head. It's a good thing for men to cover their head. So there are adat, or characteristics and qualities within cultures. When Islam comes to a culture, it shakes things up like a sieve, minkhal. And it will separate what is good from the culture and what is bad. And this is why, if you travel across the Muslim world, Muslims aren't all eating Arab food. Right? The Arabs have peculiar foods, and even within Arab cultures there are differences. So if you go to the Arabian Peninsula, they don't eat like the Syrians, they don't eat like the Yemenis, they don't eat like the North Africans. If you go to Indonesia, they eat different food. If you go to China, Chinese Muslims eat Chinese food. So these are just qualities and characteristics of culture that Islam leaves within the realm of mubah, within the realm of norm, within the realm of custom. But when the culture has a custom that goes against the teachings of Islam, then it is incumbent upon the people within that culture, when they embrace Islam, to relinquish those things and to abandon them. That's what the Muslim is commanded to do, to leave jahiliya, to leave the ignorance of the previous life. So when we do that, what we're doing is we're submitting to a teaching. And what we are saying, and this is the power of religion over the mind of the human creature. Because when a human being embraces a religion, what they are doing is they are recognizing there is truth outside of my experience. I recognize that truth and I'm submitting to that truth. And so a person who fully surrenders to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is willing at that point to abandon his previous or her previous worldview for the truth. And that's an amazing thing. And people have done it. Historically, people have done that. The human being can do that. If you look at when Islam moved to Africa. See, Islam civilized Africa. In the same way that Christianity civilized Europe to a certain degree. Every culture is based on a book. It is the book that civilizes people. It is the book that brings consciousness to people. It is the book that humanizes people. And every culture has a book. And the book of Islam is the Qur'an. The book of the Muslim peoples is the Qur'an. So when the Muslims went to Africa, they went into cultures that had many, many jahiliya practices. And they abandoned those practices for the truth of Islam. But then the practices reemerge. And this is an interesting phenomenon, because we have to ask, where is this reemergence from? Where is it coming from? To give you an example, I don't know how many people know about Burning Man. Anybody here know about Burning Man? Burning Man is a phenomenon in California that started, I think, about 10 or 15 years ago, where a man who had lovelorn troubles, he'd lost his girlfriend or something, and somebody told him, we should do something to get your mind off this. So they decided to build a 40-foot man of wood and burn him. Like, whatever gets you through the night, right? So they did this, and they took this huge wood man to a beach in San Francisco, and they reassembled it. And there was this huge man, and then they put gas and lit it on fire. And suddenly everybody on the beach came, and it happened to be the time of the solstice. All these people came onto the beach and surround, and they recognized something amazing is happening here. In fact, one woman actually touched, put her hand into the fire and got severely burnt, touching this burning man. And this became a ritual that was repeated now every year. The last one that was, I think, is somewhere near Barstow or something. There were over 20,000 people there. And it's like a Dionysian. It's become like this cult, Dionysian cult.
In New Mexico, this is Zobra.
All these times. It's a Dionysian cult. They go and they dance naked. And it's a very, very strange thing. But the burning man is Wicker Man. You see, the pagans in Europe used to do this same thing. Build this huge man from wicker and fill it with offerings to their pagan gods and burn them. It was a ritual they did around the solstice. So where does that emerge from? For the Muslims, we would say this is shaitan bringing back his gifts to the culture. Really, there's something within the human condition where these things reemerge again and again. And the thing about shaitan, which is interesting, is he is not original. Shaitan doesn't come every... He's always coming with the same thing. They slightly change and there'll be variations of them and things. But they're basically similar things. He brings a type of jahiliyyah to people's... And for some reason, although there are similarities around the world, there are going to be different ones for different cultures and different peoples because peoples are not the same and they're different. So this same thing, phenomena, occurs within the Muslim cultures. A jahiliyyah re-emerges that had been absent. It's almost like it went to sleep and then somebody wakes it up. And the Prophet cursed the one who wakes up a sleeping fitna. In other words, fitna can go to sleep, but it doesn't mean it's not there. And it can be aroused. So, the Sharia is the protection for us. This is what protects us. Allah says, if you disagree about a thing, فَرُدُّهُ إِلَى اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِهِ. Take it back to Allah and His Messenger. ذَلِكَ خَيْرٌ. Right? That's better for you. Right? وَأَحْسَنُ تَأْوِيلًا. And that's the most perfect of interpretations, of understanding. So take things back to Allah and His Messenger. What does Allah and His Messenger say here? Now when we submit to Allah and His Messenger, what we are submitting to is we are submitting to the fact that Allah and His Messenger know what is good for us. Allah knows what is good for us, and He taught His Messenger what is good for us, and His Messenger communicated to us what is good for us. The Prophet ﷺ said, I did not find any evil except that I warned you about it. Nor did I know of any good except that I showed you the path to it. That's a blessing from our Prophet. Everything that he prohibited us to do, he did it because he knew there was harm in it for us. Everything that he told us to do, he did it because he knew there was good in it for us. And Allah is the one who taught him that through Jibreel alayhi salam. So to understand Sharia is to understand that this is for the benefit of the human being. And the first and primary benefit is the preservation of the true deen with Allah, which is Tawheed. The deen is Tawheed. The Sharia will differ, but the deen is Tawheed. And this must be preserved within the human community. What Tawheed does is it frees people from the chains, from the yoke of creation. And the free man in Islam is not like people in this culture think. People in this culture associate liberty, right? It's a Latin word, liber, free. Liberty with freedom. They associate this idea that I'm free to do what I want. Now the problem with that argument is that if the person is doing what their nafs wants, they're not free. They're a slave. That true freedom is doing what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants. That is freedom by definition in Islam. The Abdullah is the only real hur. That's the only free human being. Is the one who's a servant to Allah and no longer a slave to himself. And the one who is a slave to himself is not free and will never be free until he's freed of himself. And this is why in the Arabic language, the word for freed slave is also the word for master, mawla. Mawla is from the addadad. It's from the words that have an opposite meaning. Mawla is a master, like we call Allah, mawlana. Mawla is master, and Mawla is freed slave. So the freed slave is the one who is a master of himself. That is the freed slave. And the one who is a slave to himself is a slave and has no freedom. So no matter how much freedom they give people in this culture or any other culture, if they're out fornicating, if they're out chasing their personal passions, if their passions take them to destruction, if their addictions take them to destruction, they're not free, they're slaves. They're just slaves to the wrong thing. They're Abdul Makhluq and they're not Abdul Khaliq. They're a slave of creation and they're not a slave of the Creator. And this is why Amr ibn Rab'i, his great statement, he's a Bedouin man, comes into the court of Kisra, the great Persian, Khosrows. And he asked him, what's this thing you're calling us to? And he said, we are calling you to becoming those who worship the Creator of things and not those who are slaves of created things. We are coming to free you from the slavery of things to the slavery of the Creator of things. And that's real freedom. And that's what Islam came to offer to the human condition. If you accept that, and understand that, then deen is the first thing and the tawheed is the most important thing, because once you understand that Allah is the only one who can harm you, Allah is the only one that can benefit you, then you're freed of superstitions. Look at the superstitions in cultures. They're everywhere, rife. Cultures are rife with superstition. This country is filled with superstition. Why don't they have a 13th floor in their buildings? Seriously, why don't they have a 13th floor? You go to a hospital, they don't have a 13th floor. I'm not making that up. Why? A society built on rationalism? Why does it go from 12 to 14? Seriously, it's an interesting question. Why are people afraid to go out on Friday the 13th? Why are people afraid when a black cat crosses them? Why are they afraid of broken mirrors? Why are they afraid of opening umbrellas in a house? This is really, there's people all over this country that knock wood, right? You've seen people do that, right? Now, why are they doing it? You can say, well, it's just, you know, it's just a wives' tale, they called them, right? No, why are you still doing it? Right? So, people are filled with superstition. Islam came to free us from all that. And there are those who say, well, the Muslims are superstitious. Don't you do all these prayers to protect yourself? Don't you do all the... Really, they'll say that. They'll say, you have superstition. Ours is different. I knock wood. You say, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ. مُشَتَّانَمَ بَيْنَهُمَا. What a difference between the two. Really. You know, one is from reality and the other is wahm. It's just an illusion. So the first is the preservation of deen. And that is primary. Because we'll even give our life to preserve the deen. Really, the life has to be even given to maintain the preservation of deen. The next is the preservation of life. Sharia came to preserve life. And this is why if you kill a person, you are killed. لَكُمْ فِي الْقِصَاصِ حَيَةٍ. You have in retribution life. So if somebody kills a life unjustly, they forfeit their life. And in that is life for the society. It is a deterrent. Right? Deter in Latin means to wash out dirt, filth. You see. It's a deterrent. You have to get rid of it before it spread. Like gangrene. You have to cut off part of the body in order to save the whole body. So, life is one of the things Sharia came to preserve. And it gave us rules to preserve life. And then it came to preserve nasab, which is lineage. People, it is a right of a human being to know who their people are. You should know who you're from. Like what happened in this country with the African black people in this country in the 1950s, really it goes back to earlier than that, but the idea of attaching an X to the name. That was a statement. You know, this is what the nationalist movement was making. What they were saying is X is the mathematical symbol for the unknown. And what we're doing is rejecting our slave name, like Washington. See, a black man whose name is Washington, he didn't come over on the Mayflower, right? He didn't come over on the Mayflower. Why does he have a nice Anglo-Saxon name? Because that was a name that was just given to him, right? Some of the blacks, when they were freed, they literally just gave them the names. Washington, Jefferson, Carver, Smith, like that, just names. And some of them took the names of their masters, like that. So what they were doing is they were saying, no, we don't accept that anymore. We don't know who we are, but we know we're not Washington. Right? At least we know that now. They didn't know that for a long time, so that's a type of consciousness. But what they were saying is, we don't know, and this is a right that was taken away from us. That was taken away from us. They were literally stripped from their families. And that was erased from their consciousness. Because children were taken from their parents and sold into slavery. And this is what happened. This happened in this country. So a human being has the right to know his lineage, who he is, who your father is. And this is why in fornication the rules are so strong. Because with fornication that breaks down. And this is why a woman who bears a child out of childbirth, even if the father is quote unquote known, that child does not out of wedlock. Even if the child is born out of wedlock and knows the father, right? And knows the father, the child does not take that father's name. Doesn't take the name. A bastard cannot say, that's my father. By Sharia. Cannot say that. Even if you did a genetic test, anything. No. A Ibn Zina has no lineage. By Sharia. None. Why? Because every religion, every deen has recognized marriage. Every deen. Marriage is the way lineage is preserved. The Muslims are polygynous and not, they are not polyandrous. Because a woman will not know if she takes more than one husband, who is the father of the child. And you can't say, oh, well, we could do a DNA test. 80% of the world doesn't have telephones. Right? You know, DNA tests aren't cheap. They cost a lot of money. Right? 80% of the world doesn't have telephones. So don't use this, the people of Bayan, they say, أَشَّدْ يُحْفَظْ وَلَا يُقَاسْ عَلَيْهِ. The anomaly is something you keep in mind, but you don't use it as a standard to measure things. So, and Islam permits polygyny because the lineage can be preserved. If there's one progenitor, a woman will know, if she guards her private parts, she will know who is the father of her husband, who is the father of her child. And the child has a right. Now, if a man has an amma, which is a bondswoman, and the bondswoman only becomes impregnated, she becomes walad. Just by becoming impregnated, by missing a period, she's walad. If the child is born, the child is the legal son or the legal daughter of that man by Sharia. There are no bastard children in Islam. Islam came to eliminate that. You see? And one of the things the Prophet ﷺ said, if a culture, if fornication becomes prevalent in a culture, then prepare yourselves for the wrath of Allah. You see? And the wrath is in those children. Because they're filled with rage. And look at what we've now reaching 50% in this country. Children born out of wedlock, we're reaching 50% or past. And look at all the crimes. Look at all the violence. There's rage. If you go into the prisons in this country and ask these men, they don't have fathers. They didn't have fathers. They don't even know who their fathers were. That is oppression. That's unjust. You can't do that to a human being. They have the right to know who their father is. And so Islam came to preserve that right through the prohibition of fornication and through the guidelines of Sharia in proper marriage. And this is why Islam recognized any marriage outside of Islam. If two people become Muslim, they do not have to renew a marital contract. Islam recognizes marriages of other deens. You see, it doesn't. It's as long as it is a marriage that is recognized by the custom of a people. But two people living together with no responsibilities, Islam rejects that completely. And people forget that in 1968, it was major news in this country that a woman on the East Coast was kicked out of her university because she was living in sin. 1968, kicked out of a university because she was living in sin. People forget how quickly morals have changed in this culture. There was an article in News and World Report about fornication, premarital sex. And what they were saying was even conservatives won't condemn adult consensual premarital sex. They'll condemn teenage sex, but they will not condemn adult, consenting adults, because everybody's doing it, the article said. Well, why should the children, why should the teenagers not do it? If that's their example. You see? Why? And everything in this culture is saying have fun, enjoy yourself. The media is showing it, promoting fornication. Most of the television sitcoms and the films, they don't have relationships. Marriages are usually dull and boring on television, uninteresting. It's soap operas. What's exciting is illicit relations. Really? This is what they're seeing, and this is what they're being conditioned to believe. They keep their father's name. They can call the stepfather, what they want, nickname or whatever, but they have to understand that the stepfather is the stepfather. He is not a legal father. He's actually only a guardian. He's not a stepfather. We don't even have that term. We do not have adoption. And the reason for adoption is, see what happens, if I adopt a child, and my last name is Hansen, and that child takes my last name, 3-4 generations down the road, they forget that there was an adoption. And suddenly they think that's their lineage. So lineage is maintained in Islam. Islam abrogated adoption, did not allow for adoption. The Prophet ﷺ adopted Zayd, called him Zayd ibn Muhammad. And fostering is, the Prophet said, I and the one who takes care of an orphan are like this in Jannah. You put these two fingers together, it's one of the highest things you can do. Right? Kafiru yatim is one of the highest things you could do, to take care of people that don't have parental care. One of the highest things in Islam you can do. But you cannot say, this is my son, this is my daughter. That's a lie. That's a lie. They are not your son and daughter. And they're not your stepson, not your stepdaughter. You say, this is my ward. Right, exactly. It's my ward.
You said that the Prophet did...
He adopted Zayd, absolutely. And he announced it at the Kaaba.
So he did
it? No, that was abrogated. The Prophet ﷺ was prohibited to do that after.
Oh,
yes, he did that
before.
Yes, absolutely.
So what did you
know? He did that before Islam.
Are there any guidelines for adopting orphans? Are there any books or things that you refer to, especially for this culture?
Kafala is in fiqh, kafala is a, what's called kafala, which is taking care. It's taking care of the needs of children that don't have those to take care of them. Highly encouraged.
Do they explain like how to deal with a child when they're infant? Like, what if we adopt the child as infant? The child needs to know that the parents are not the original parents.
Right, they need to be told that. And this is a big trauma in this country for many people who find out that they've been adopted. Big trauma.
Is it true if you cannot give the child your last name?
Only if it's your legal child. Like adopted, yeah, you cannot give it your last name. It has its last name. Even the woman is not supposed to take your name. She's not Mrs. So-and-so. She has her own lineage, and that should be preserved. She's not, she hasn't become you. Right? That's a co-option. It's not part of the Muslim tradition. This is a bid'ah. And it's bid'ah muharramah to do that, to give a woman a name that's not her lineage. No, she has her own. She's the so-and-so, the daughter of so-and-so. And we're patrilineal. The lineage goes through the father. Sometimes, rarely, men were attributed to a woman because of her righteousness. I mean, that does happen. Like Ibn Taymiyyah. Taymiyyah is from his grandmother. Right? Taymiyyah was a woman. So that does happen. You know, sometimes. But we are not matrilineal. We're a patrilineal deen. The deen is patrilineal.
I'm wondering, you know, what you're saying. First, it sounds like a couple, if they were barren, could go through an adoption agency and raise a child as long as they're here to travel.
Absolutely. No, they can do what this culture calls adoption. You could do that legally, but you cannot say, this is my child.
If the child is older and not Muslim, at that time,
Can you foster a non-Muslim child, or would you have to teach the child? I mean, obviously, you want to teach the child Islam,
but how
does that look? Like an adult, you mean, to take? Yeah. See, in Sharia, if they've reached puberty, they're not children anymore.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking about is, in the States, you call a foster parent situation. Like, if you have a troubled youth, right, longer than puberty. but not infant.
There's nothing that says you can't help them if you want to. You can do that. Nothing in Sharia says you can't help them.
I know a sister who has adopted Muslim children, and the community knows that they are adopted, and they're small. And at one point, as children play, the other children teach them to tell them that they didn't, that that's not your mother. And she adopted them at a very early age, that the only mother that they know.
They tease them?
Yeah, other.
Well, that's, you know, Lord of the Flies syndrome. Right?
And
children can be very cruel to other children. That's why you want to have your children around children that are well raised and learn not to do things like that. You know, not all children tease. You know, really. I mean, children should be socialized into respect and should learn that they shouldn't do, and they can. Not something they can't do, you know. And they will fall into things like that, but they should learn to respect, you know, the feelings of others even at an early age. And that can be done. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have two questions. The first one was with the bond woman.
Right.
She has a child by the man.
Then she goes, she's no longer a bondswoman. She becomes what's called walad. Right. She cannot be sold. And the child is a legal child of that man and inherits and everything. It's the son of that man and takes the man's name.
Okay. The second question is, if a woman wanted to take her husband's last name, would that be permissible?
If she wanted to take her husband's last name?
Yes.
You know, I don't know. I let me check on that. All right, I'd prefer to, because I don't want to do. I mean, I have an idea, and I don't want to give a definitive because I'm not sure. So let me ask Sheikh Abdullah what he says, or tomorrow Sheikh Abdullah, who's a mufti. The man coming tomorrow is a mufti.
What if her last name is not a Muslim last name, and then she marries a Muslim?
No, it doesn't have to be the Sahaba had last names; they weren't Muslim. Their fathers were mushrikeen, pagans. You know, Umar ibn al-Khattab was not a Muslim. And it doesn't, name is a name. The name of your father is your father. Whether he's Muslim or not doesn't matter. That's your name. You know, like my name, my father's name was Hansen. That was his father's name and his father's name and his father's name. Goes back to whoever the first Hans, you know, it means John. Right, son of John, Ibn Yahya. That's what it means. You know, it's just that's the way the Europeans said Ibn Yahya, Hans' son of Hans. Hans is Yohanna.
If our lineage is important that way, then why don't we convert you to
take the name? Oh, that's a first name, which is a choice. You don't have to take a Muslim name. If you become Muslim, you don't have to take. I shouldn't say a Muslim name. I would just say you don't have to take an Arabic name. Right. I mean, there were. Many cultures where they didn't all adopt Muslim names, you still go to Shiraz. We have a Shiraz here. We have a Shir. Shir is a Persian name. You know, we have Mehnaz. Many names in, right? There are many, many names. Persian names are very common. Even some Arabs name their women Persian names. You'll find Persian names in the Arab communities, right? You'll find Turkish names. In the Arab world. That's just something, you know, in many cultures when you convert, even within the Christian tradition, you often took a name. Like even within the Catholic tradition, when you go into an order that and you read your vows, they often took a name of one of the righteous, the pious ancestors, so that they would become their name might have been Christopher or whatever, and then they take their vow, they become Paul, or they become Peter, or they become, I mean, even Paul's name was Saul. When he converted, he became Paul. So this is just a tradition within many cultures. The Prophet did not change people's names unless they were bad names, because one of the rights of a child is to be given a good name by the father. So if he found somebody's name was inappropriate, he would change it. Like Shaqi means wretched. He said, no, your name's Sa'id, which means happy, felicitous. That's all. So if you want to take a name, you can take a name. If you don't want to, you don't have to. And there's an interesting book called Dawah in America, written by a Christian missionologist, which is people who study conversion. And he's actually not a Christian, he's a researcher. And he was doing this as an academic exercise. And one of the things he said in there is that he studied the reasons people convert, and I think he identified about 10 dominant reasons, and he said that Islam was uniquely the only religion amongst the religions that Americans convert to that had all 10 of the reasons. And he said, so he had to deduce from that that the Muslims were just doing a really bad job at presenting their religion because they had so few conversions. But one of the things he said is he felt that Americans would not convert if they felt that they had to take Arabic names, right? And he actually felt that Muslims should, if an American does become a Muslim, they should just keep their American name. That was his idea, anyway. I mean, he's not a Muslim, but it's an interesting concept, you know. So.
Is it preferred but not required for Muslims to name their children?
You don't have to name your child an Arabic name. Nothing in Sharia says that you have to name your child an Arab. There are good names to name because of who the people were. And the Prophet definitely said, خَيْرُ الْأَسْمَامَ عُبِدَ وَحُمِدَ. The best names are those that have abd in them or have praise, like Mahmud, Hamid, Ahmed, Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Those type names. Hamid, right? Those are the best names. And Abdurrahman, there's another riwayah that's Abdurrahman. But you could, if you were Greek, you could name your child Demetrius. There's nothing in Sharia says you can't do that. Right? I actually thought about doing that, one of my sons. I didn't, but I thought my grandfather's name was Demetrius. You know, I thought about doing that. You know, Demi. Demi. Sounds too much like demon. So, you know, that's... Nesb is important. First name, as long as you give them a good name. You know. There were, Juraij is a name that comes in the hadith. And Juraij is George. And the Prophet praised a monk whose name was Juraij. And you will find some Muslims that had that name, historically. George, Juraij. Right? Juraij is a Greek name, Yorgo. Right? So it's in the hadith. It's in a Sahih Hadith, Juraij. The Prophet, he was one of the people that, you know, the infant spoke to because, you know the story of Juraij, the monk? These people were very envious of him. And so they wanted to destroy his reputation. And so they paid a prostitute to go to his monastery, because he's a very righteous Christian. And she came at the night and she said, I don't have a place to stay. Will you let me in? And so he was, you know, his humanity was there. But at the same time, he was worried because monks flee the world. And women, you know, that was symbolic of the world for monks in a lot of ways. So, but his humanity, you know, the spirit of the law overrode the law. And so he let her into the monastery. And then she tried to seduce him. And he would put his hand into the candle to remind himself of the fire. So he did not sleep with her. But she went, and then on the way back, she failed. But she met a shepherd on the road back. And she seduced him, and she became impregnated. And she claimed that Juraij seduced her. So the people went and tore down his monastery. And then when the child was born... they went to the child, and the child said she lied. The child in the cradle said she lied. I'm the son of the shepherd, and so they knew that Juraij was he was such a righteous man. That was a miracle that Allah gave to prove his innocence, and they built him a monastery with gold and right. People are pretty horrific, right? Whoops, sorry.
See, how about the other way around? Someone has a Muslim name and they change that.
But well, people do that, yeah. They change their names. That's pretty sad. Let's put it that way. I don't think it's, I don't know if you could actually say that would be haram to do that. Unless he changed his last name, which is prohibited. In fact, the Prophet said that anybody that called themselves by other than the name of their father, that he was free from them. He had no relation with them. That's one of the things you cannot do. So somebody, you know, who was, whose last name was, Zain al-Abidin, and he changed it to Smith or something like that. Can't do that. But if his name was Muhammad and he came here and he changed it to Mo, you know, that they do that, things like that, right?
Well, what if he was a non-Muslim and he changed his last name to Muslim?
Well, when I converted, my father's name was and my grandfather's name were Joseph, and I asked my sheikh if I could be Bin Yusuf. I asked him that, and he said that I could do that. So I don't know. Allah Ta'ala alam. But I went back to Hansen. You know, so for a long time, that's what I went by. I Arabized my name, and then I just thought, you know, I'm not an Arab, so there's no reason why I should have an Arab name. As I kind of matured and got older, you know. You're young, you're kind of zealous. And so
then would you recommend for someone to change their last name if they convert?
No. Just I wouldn't. In fact, I really have reservations. I don't think it changed their name at all. I don't, legally, because I have more problems in the Muslim world when they go to visit with a Muslim name than they would with a non-Muslim name, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So, because I've had that. I've suffered because of it. I've been denied entry into countries with an American passport simply because I had an Arab name in my passport. And I watched Americans go in next to me. Right? So I just, you know, why bring yourself that trouble? There's no reason why you should do that. You know, there's nothing in Sharia says you have to change your name. If you want to take a Muslim name, that's perfectly fine. You know, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's probably a good thing.
Just the first name though, right?
Yeah, the first name. I wouldn't change the last name personally. Again, these are just, you know, but if you're denying your father, that's wrong to do that.
When you were talking about African Americans earlier, because they were received slaves, mm-hmm. Does that then make it different in their case? Because that technically is not their.
Yeah, that's a good point that you're raising. I think that's a very valid point. And I would have to think about that, maybe ask some people about that. But I think that's a really good point. I think that's what a lot of people do, like Malik Shabazz. He took that name Shabazz, and his wife Betty took that name as well.
It would be difficult to trace that name or something back to your forefathers.
Yeah. So lineage, right, is preservation of lineage, and then preservation of wealth, property. That is a right. It's a human right. And, you know, it's interesting. All property is theft. I mean, what a bit piece of sophistry that is. All property is theft. Because you can't have the concept of theft without property. Right? There's no concept of theft without property. All property is theft. Yeah, that was one of Marx, you know, Marxist ideas. All property is theft, right? You know, the idea that everything should be communally. Communal property.
One example that I've come across relating to that is a Muslim man, actually it was a man married to a Muslim. He was not a Muslim. She was a Muslim, and she was taking money without him knowing it from his wallet or things like
right.
that. He was very upset about it. But the question came up, well, because for her, the money within the family was not property. It was she felt that it was the family.
Communally owned. Community property.
Yeah. Is that true within the family?
No. Not at all.
Isn't the hand cut if one of the spouses goes into a locked thing owned by
No. That's very hard to... You know, within families, there's completely different, you know, Yeah. But the, you know, Hind came and said that she used to take property from Abu Sufyan without him knowing. And the Prophet, because he said Abu Sufyan was a miser. And the Prophet ﷺ said, take it, you know, with him knowing. Take what you need. You have a permission, you have a right to the amount that you need. But he should know about it. So that was the fatwa. Radiallahu anhum jamian. So the idea that of preservation of property is that theft, the rules applying to theft, the cutting of the hand, which is, that is radical. Right? The cutting of the hand is a very radical concept. Now, there is, it has to be from a hirs, you know, it has to be, like if we left something outside, like I left my bicycle outside unlocked, right? And somebody took it. There's it has to be in a place that's recognized as, that you cannot go into it. If you leave something out for people that, that is not a hirs, you know, that's not protected area or protected space. And it's interesting, I'll tell you something very, really interesting about Sharia. if I go and like, if I go to Hakim and he's got a bunch of money in his hand and I start fighting him, beat him up and take his money, there's no cutting of the hand there. That's called ghasab, a ghasab. The cutting of the hand is if it's when it's done furtively. It's very interesting. And the idea is that if you're a ghasib, there's more, you know, it's less dishonorable. In other words, at least you're giving a person the opportunity to fight for his property. But if you steal it from him without even giving him that opportunity, it's like it's, you've reached the depths of depravity. You know, it's just, it's, no, if you hurt them, then there's diyat. There's diyat, that, you know, there's blood money and there's retribution. That's different. But somebody, what they call a mugger, who comes and takes, as long as they don't have a weapon, if they have a weapon, then that's actually the worst form. That is armed robbery, which the punishment is death. You see, armed robbery is even if they don't kill anybody. If a man goes into a store with a gun and points that gun at a person, then that the punishment is death. In fact, very severe. It's one of the worst things you can do. Because the society, the one thing that people should feel within a society is security in their being. That is the most important thing, is feeling a sense of security, which is protection of self. Human beings should feel safe in their homes and safe in their streets. They should have that sense of safety. You know, you shouldn't have to worry about, who's this guy behind me? You know, people should not have to feel that fear. So the society, the Islamic laws are very severe when it comes to these fundamental breaches of human rights. Or not human, I don't like that word, of shara'ik rights. Because we don't have human rights. We have legal rights that are given to us by Allah. Not by solely our humanity. They're given to us from Allah. God-given rights, thank you. That's the old-fashioned way of saying it. Human rights are modern concept.
The idea of transgenders and making people pay for a space for a certain amount of money.
Yeah, that would go under like maslaha. I mean, technically, as the government could do that if it was seen as a maslaha. Traffic laws generally go under the rules of musalih and mursada, which is where there's public benefit. So technically, because the reason there's traffic laws is to protect people's lives. So, by the Sharia, you should follow traffic laws. You should follow traffic laws by Sharia. In fact, some of the muftis have said that if you purposely go through a red light, you should say Astaghfirullah. Yeah. Because it's endangering other lives, and those laws were established for public safety. And that relates to Sharia. The Sharia honors that. In fact, it incorporates it. I know. And we're in the Bay Area and it's really bad, right? Because making people pay for parking spaces, right? When I was young, we used to, I mean, it's the old days, right? We used to go down downtown, and you know, you weren't supposed to, I can't remember what they called it. What do they call that? Loitering, or right? We used to put money into the meters and just sit, you know, in the parking space and say, "Hey, we rented this place." rebels without cause, right?
How many people can sit in one place? That's the question.
So the next is preservation of aql, of the intellect. You have to preserve the intellect, because that's where we were honored, with the intellect. So Sharia came to preserve the intellect. So it prohibited things that harm the intellect. So anything that harms the intellect, Sharia says, avoid it, to preserve your intellect. Like intoxicants. They harm the intellect. And now the amazing thing about it is, you know, 1400 years later, oh, by the way, every time you have a glass of wine, you destroy all these brain cells. Right? Literally. You kill brain cells. And then there's people who say, well, we've got so many, that's okay, right? I mean, we can afford to lose a few, right? Right? The problem is, how do you know you're not losing the right ones, right? Maybe it's the reserve ones that you don't lose. It's the ones you're using, right? Because we're only using what, point, I think it's, now it's 0.01 or something. It used to be 10% of the brain, and now then it went to 5%. Now they say it's less than 1% of the brain is actually being used, right? Latest neuro. I mean, these are theories, obviously. But they, the reason they got that information is because they had people that were hydrocephalic, who had literally less than 5% of normal brain mass, born with that. And they had normal IQs and went to universities and got degrees. Right? With literally less than 5% of what the brain mass that we have. And I really think in some ways, Allah Ta'ala anam, this is purely speculation. I have absolutely no evidence for this. But I think in some ways, what they call a fath from Allah, an opening. Like, I think people like Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, you know, they were probably like given like just massive amount of intellect. You know, it was opened up for them. People like that. Because you wonder, I mean, how these people could write what they wrote. You know, man writes 400 books and, you know, just the things that they knew. And just sitting with some of the people that I've sat with, like Murab Darhaj, who's mastered, I mean, he's mastered around, you know, 15 sciences, that just one of them, if you master that in your lifetime, that is a major accomplishment. I'm not making that up. I mean, just the Arabic language, if you mastered that in a lifetime, nowadays, that is a major accomplishment. Because these so-called doctors, PhDs in Arabic language, they have nowhere near the mastery of these people in the desert. Really, they don't. So, you know, you just wonder, what is all that massive cerebral power to do that? Some kind of opening from Allah. You know, it's an opening, quite literally. Allahu Ta'ala. So, how? Where did we go? We said the light, the deen,
intellect,
nafs, right, nasab, wealth, and intellect. Those are the five. Now, there's a sixth one which is called the ird, and honor, which is added often. And Muslim put that under nasab also, that it's your lineage is part of your honor. But here, these are the rules that prohibit slander, calumny, accusing people. This is why, even if you see a person, you know, you go into a room and there you see two people, you know they're not married, and something that shouldn't be happening is happening. It is haram for you to go and tell anybody? Haram. You have to veil them. And that relates to their right to honor. And part of the reason that you veil people is because if people become known for doing wrong things, tawbah is harder. Do you see what I mean? Because people will always see them as, you know, oh, that's the guy that used to own the liquor store. Seriously, he might have made tawbah, but people will still bring up that years later. And I've seen this in Muslim communities. Somebody will literally make tawbah, and yet it will be brought up, you know. Oh, by the way, did you know he used to own a liquor store? Right?
So what about this Qadi thing and three witnesses and
four witnesses?
Four witnesses.
If you veil it, so we don't talk about that. We don't want to press charges if there's witnesses.
No, you don't want to press charges. You want to veil people.
But four simultaneous witnesses is not
almost impossible.
That's a public act.
You still want to veil it?
Yeah, it's a public act.
How could you be veiling that? That has to happen.
Public
in public.
Act.
Yeah.
Four people, and you have to four people that actually see penetration. And the way it's described in the books is like the, you know, the kuhul, the kol, the oud, the stick that goes into the kuhul bottle. It has to be like the kuhul, the stick into the kuhul bottle. Or like the bucket into the well. That has to be seen by all four people. Can't just be a man on top of a woman. And it's, yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, if somebody came into the room, first thing they do is, whoop, you know, shut the door and get out of there. They're not going to start going and investigating. Right? Let me make sure I'm seeing what I'm seeing is really happening. I just don't imagine that. And you have to have a very strange person that's going to, you know. I mean, the Sharia is there to veil people. It's not there to expose people's faults. And the Prophet didn't want to hear it. A woman came and confessed to him, you know. One man went to Abu Bakr and he said, you know, I commit fornication. Abu Bakr said, did you tell anybody? He said, no. He said, then don't tell anybody. Make tawbah. It was still bothering him. He went to Omar. Look what Omar said. Did you tell anybody? This is from the same school. Did you tell anybody? He said, Abu Bakr. What did he say? He said, don't tell anybody. Why are you telling me? Don't. Say astaghfirullah and don't tell anybody. And it was still bothering the man. He went to the Prophet ﷺ. And the Prophet had the had punishment established, you know. And in the one riwayah of the woman who was stoned, who confessed, she was stoned after giving birth, after nursing her child for 2 years, she still came back. And she was stoned. And somebody mentioned something about her, cursing her. And the Prophet said, don't curse that woman. If her blood was spilt across this city, all of the people in the city would be forgiven. You know. In other words, that is a real tawbah. Right? So, and that's the thing, is those people wanted the punishment in this world, not that they... Because if you have the had punishment, that's it in this world. It's finished. Whereas if you don't, you're in the Mashiach. Do you see what I mean? They were worried about, is this tawbah going to be accepted? So, and historically there have been very few people that have been punished. And another thing about Sharia, in confession, if a person leaves the pit, you have to stop. If they get out of the pit by their own volition, then you have to stop. You can't continue to stone them.
What about somebody who's still...
There's a pit in which they're stoned in. And if they leave the pit, that people have to stop. They can't stone them. They only stone them as long as they stay in the pit. If they leave the pit, they have to stop. Because confession is, you know, Allah Ta'ala anam.
You can complete the gate.
That's hajj. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though
he
left before.
What about somebody steal? If you see somebody stealing, do you veil them or do you scream?
Well, if you know that they've stolen.
You see somebody.
No, you should stop somebody if you're able to. You stop them from
running.
Stealing.
He's screaming,
stop, thief! Yeah. Sariq, sariq.
They're not tied down in the pit or held down?
No.
Yeah.
Very few people historically have been killed that way in the Muslim world, really. Very few people. It was not a common. There's probably more nowadays, like, Arabia just does it too. That's tough. I don't want to go into this. Yeah, there's no had punishment now. There cannot be had without Khalifa. Khalifa establishes had. There's no had punishment. And the other thing is, you can't establish had punishment in places where you have 80% unemployment. And you can't, you know, the Prophet said, لَا قَطْعَ فِي مَجَاعَ. There's no cutting of hands when there's famine. You know, Sharia is it. You're not trying to harm it. It's when you have healthy society. That's when the hudud are being implemented. Not when societies are totally dysfunctional. I mean, I've heard people say, "No, that would be impossible to do in America." Well, not that's true. You have to radically alter the American society before it's ready for Sharia. Right? Really, it has to be completely radically altered. Understandings have to change. You know. I mean, people need to be honored. People shouldn't go hungry. She didn't go hungry. That's a crime in itself, to have people in your society that are going hungry. That is a crime. Prophet ﷺ said, he does not believe the one who eats and his neighbor is hungry. That is not a believer.
So this makes the implementation of Sharia somewhat of an abstract concept at this point.
Absolutely. But it still has to be studied and understood for when the time comes. I mean, there always have to be people that know Sharia, whether it's being implemented or not. And the Prophet ﷺ told us that the first thing to go would be the hudud, the rules of governance. That would be the first thing it would go. He said it would go step by step till nothing remained but the prayer. And that's the time we're in now. We're just holding, clinging to the prayer and to fasting. And we pay zakat out of conscientious behavior, not because we're forced to. You know, in the olden days, they had zakat collectors came and you paid zakat.
There's still time for our lives, the Sharia. I mean, even though there,
you can impose upon yourself, absolutely. I mean,
we should, shouldn't we?
Absolutely, yeah, to the best of our ability. But I can't, in America, I can't establish a had. If I have a community, I was in a community where a woman and a man did commit adultery, and there was a mufti there who was asked, Sheikh Shaybani, very excellent mufti with a lot of taqwa. He was asked what to do. He said just, if she made tawbah, accept the tawbah. And just veil her. And don't talk about it. That's what he said. Just veil her. And accept the tawbah. You know, don't ostracize them. Don't. Right? It's a bad time. Part of this condition that we're in. So. Mm-hmm.
So, with the Sharia courts, and the countries, would they be wrong passing?
Well, technically, if, like, King Hassan is, you know, he's the ruler of his country, and he's called Amir al-Mu'mineen in his country. That's what he calls himself, Amir al-Mu'mineen. What's that?
You said it has to be under a caliph.
Well, technically the ruler of a country, because even though the people of Sunnah and Jama'ah say that there should be one ruler, the Prophet indicated towards the end of time there would be many rulers. So technically, if a ruler did establish Sharia, like in Sudan, that is valid, that they do have that authority because they are a sultan. Because Islam prohibits anarchy. There always has to be some government. Even if it's a non-Muslim government, there has to be some governing body. You cannot have anarchy. Yeah, you can, like, see, there's some communities in this country that want to establish had. They can't do that. Then it becomes vigilantism. And who are they to do that? They don't have the authority by Sharia. Allah did not give us that authority. I mean, I can't just declare myself Khalifa of California, you know, and take bay'ah with me. And then if somebody does something wrong, I tell some of the brothers, go out and, you know, whip them. I can't do that. Right? I can't do that.
In California, anything's possible.
Right, in California, right? So those are the six mahfudat. Alright, kulliyat al-khams. And that's what Sharia came to protect. And all of the rules of Sharia can be found to something related to those things. All of them. If you look. All of them. Like fasting is part of the preservation of deen because you learn taqwa. And it's also preservation of the body because you become healthy. Sumu tasihu. The rules related to prayer, preservation of deen. Also preservation of intellect, because one of the things about prayer is that it balances the intellect. People that don't pray have more psychic troubles than people that pray. Even by within cultures, you know, like in this country, people that pray, they've done, the Christians have done a lot of research on it, but there's physicians, Dossie, what's his name?
Larry Dossie.
Very interesting research has been done. People that are religious in this country, whether they're Christian, Buddhist, other, have lower blood pressure, lower heart disease, lower, right? So there are benefits in these things, even in other traditions. The five most important principles in the principles of jurisprudence. The first is that matters are based on the intentions behind them.
What does that mean? That umur bi maqasidiha. That in Sharia, you have to look at what the intention behind the affair is, the amr. And that is what things are based on, and nothing else. So if a person says, anta tariq, inshaAllah, you're divorced if Allah wills, that you have to ask the person, what did you mean? Did you say inshaAllah because you wanted just to make tabarruk with the name, take a blessing by mentioning Allah's name? Or did you say, if Allah wills, you're divorced? Because if you said Allah wills your divorce, then the divorce isn't binding. So you have to look at what intentions are behind actions, and what intentions are behind matters. And then certainty is not lost because of doubt. Right? Certainty is not lost due to doubt. An example of that would be, if I'm in prayer and I entered into prayer with certainty that I had wudu, and then I start doubting it, I do not leave my prayer, I finish my prayer, because I went in with yaqeen, and nothing will take me out but yaqeen. Now, if after I finish the prayer I still have doubt, and I start thinking, no, I'm not sure, then I should do the prayer over. But the doubt itself does not take me out of the prayer. Right? So yaqeen is the foundation, certainty is the foundation that is not removed by doubt.
But if it's certainty that you didn't do it.
No, then you have to leave. Yeah. But interestingly enough, if I'm an imam and I go into the prayer, Allahu Akbar, and I pray two rakats, and then I realize that I didn't even have wudu when I went into the prayer, if I leave the prayer immediately, once I realize that, then the prayer of the people praying behind me is sound, because there was certainty while I was praying.
Can I have a question? Say, like, if you're praying, but you're not sure if you missed part of the prayer and finished the prayer?
Yeah, that's a good point. Then what you do is you build on certainty. So that's a good example. Certainty is not removed by doubt. So if I pray, I'm praying my prayer, and then I'm up and I say, is this my fourth or my third rakat, right? Well, then what would you do? You would base it on three, because with three you have certainty. So you base it on three and you would pray an extra one and then do seven, do the forgetful prostration.
So you go back to where it was that you had.
Exactly. The last certainty that you have. Then you would get up and finish. What if you said salam and you're still sitting in the same place and you have doubt, if it was three or four, you get up and do a fourth one.
So if the imam leaves, what happens? Somebody else has to go and become imam at that point?
They don't have to. The imam can either, there's three possibilities. The imam can do what's called istikhlal, which he pulls somebody from the group, or the group can push somebody forward if he doesn't, or they can all pray on their own.
Can the imam come back?
You know about the man, he was doing the prayer, then he realized that he didn't have wudu. So he took the very righteous looking man in the front line and he pulled him ahead. He went, he did wudu, and he came back. The man still hadn't done anything. So he went up to him and he said, what are you doing? He said, I'm saving your place. That's actually, Ibn Jawzi relates that as a, with an isnad. In his book on fools and simpletons. It's a true story. And he relates it with his son. He wrote a joke. He said, I heard from so-and-so that he was actually there and this happened. One of them was there and one of the other. They saw a righteous man and the people praying. They said, you go ahead and lead the prayer for us. And he said, oh, no, I'm never imam unless I have wudu. So the next one is called difficulty necessitates facilitation. Difficulty necessitates facilitation. In other words, and mashaqqatun tajlib at-taysir. If there's difficulty, the Sharia says things need to be made easy for people. Because Allah, yuridu bikum al-yusr. Allah doesn't want difficulty for you. He wants ease. He gave us the Sharia to make things easy, not to make them hard. And so, la tushaddidu ala anfusikum fa yushaddidu Allah alaykum. Don't make things hard for yourself because Allah will let you do that and then you'll destroy yourself. So don't make things hard. Things are meant to be easy. Which does not mean things are meant to be easy. It means that the responsibility should not be undue duress. It shouldn't be to the point where, you know, that you're really having a hard time. You live in a place where it's daytime 20 hours a day and 4 hours it's nighttime. You don't fast 20 hours. You work it out to the closest place if you want, or some people say Mecca. The point is that you don't, because that's mashaqqa. It's harmful for the body. If a woman's pregnant and the doctor says don't fast, or she feels that it's harmful for her fetus, she doesn't fast. Right? Allah says, no, don't do that. Don't destroy yourself. If it's hard to do something, Allah gives us ease. If you can't pray standing up, you pray sitting down. And that's a principle in usul that we have to understand. I mean, the deen is not, don't go, Allah doesn't need us to torture ourselves. It's not. There's no benefit in that.
Uh-huh. What if you're pregnant and the pregnancy is causing like harm to the person? Should you have the child anyway and take the risk?
If a physician said that the pregnancy has become a danger to the life of the woman, then the pregnancy can be terminated by Sharia.
But if he doesn't,
and that
say
would
that,
be a judgment call. But the woman's life is over the life of the child by Sharia. As long as it's unborn, it's over the life. The woman's life is over the life of the child.
So there's no time period until where she's allowed to, like, where if it's too late, it's too far.
No. If they feel that, if a doctor who's, you know, knowledgeable in his field feels that there is a serious danger to this woman in continuing the pregnancy, that she probably will die. There has to be a probability. غَرَبَةَ الظَّنِّ. He will say, if this continues, this woman is going to lose her life.
So then if she goes ahead and takes a chance and has it anyway.
It's not. But she could do that technically. I mean,
what if she dies? Is that haram?
She went to the doctor though, Allahu A'lam. I mean, if she went to the doctor, generally you don't have to go to a doctor by Sharia. But if you go to a doctor, then it becomes binding on you to follow the guidelines of the doctor. You don't have to go to the doctor. If you're sick, there's nothing in Sharia says you have to go to a doctor. But if you do, then it's incumbent upon you to follow the guidelines of the physician.
Anything?
What's that?
Anything that they know? I mean, if you go to a doctor.
Well, I mean, if he says, you know, you should eat a little less or something like that, I mean, you know. But if he says, look, you have diabetes, and if you take sugar, you're going to kill yourself. Sugar becomes haram for you, and it's a tahrim aradi, it's a tahrim that's related to circumstance. It is not haram by its nature, but because of a special condition, it becomes prohibited for you. But if you never went to the doctor, then you don't have to follow that guideline. If you die, mashallah, you die. But by Sharia, you do not have to go to a doctor. Huh?
What if you doubt
there? You can go get a second opinion. Nothing in Islam says you can't get a second opinion. Go to a homeopath, right? Nothing in Sharia says you have to follow one school of medicine. Just like you don't have to follow one madhab. There's different madhabs in medicine. Chinese madhab, right? Imam Yellow Emperor, right? Homeopathic madhab, Imam Hanuman. And you can follow a different madhab of medicine.
Uh-huh.
You don't go to a witch doctor, like voodoo or something. It has to be based on something real. Uh-huh.
Back to the difficulty necessitates facilitation with your children. If you have children of age, and they say it's too difficult to wear hijab to school, and they're in a public situation,
Should
you bin? Could you facilitate that?
That is not, I wouldn't know. You see, because first of all, they don't have to go to school by Sharia. There's no law in Sharia that says you have to go to school. All you have to do is learn your fard ayn by Sharia. That's it. There's no law that says you have to have a BA. Right? Really? No law in Sharia says all you have to know, you don't even have to be literate by Sharia. You have to simply know the basic rules, know how to say Fatiha, and these things. Right? So if somebody's in school, I mean, I really think it's very detrimental to send our children to non-Muslim schools. I think it's detrimental to send them to Muslim schools. I think schools altogether are detrimental. Right? Now, some people say I have very radical ideas about education, but that's where I am. Sorry about that. You know, and I'm not. My opinion is just my opinion. It's not based on. I mean, I'm not just saying this to be like, you know, radical or something. Really, I'm not. I mean, it's based on thinking and studying the matter. And I am willing to sit with anybody who's done as much deliberation and reading and studying as I have about the situation. But somebody who just comes and they're completely brainwashed by the very system that I'm saying is really bad for the Muslims, and they start telling me that I'm wrong and they haven't looked even at any of the literature out there. I don't, there's no basis for argument, there's no basis for discussion, right? I mean, somebody, you know, I had a friend of mine, he's a hardcore technologist, and I told him, look, let me give you some books. If you read those books, we can talk about this. But if you're gonna come to me with your ideology, I know what your ideology is, I've studied it, and I'm not convinced. But I've studied people from, like, MIT, you know, Langen Winner, he's a professor of the philosophy of technology, you know, Jacques Ellul, others, who have very serious critiques about technology. Which is not saying all technology is bad, but there's questions there, there's philosophical implications to technology. If you're willing to do the study and research, then we have some grounds for discourse. But if you're just gonna, you know, tell me you're wrong and I'm right, no. And it's not fair. Right? You know, opinions have to be based on something. It just can't be, you know, you have to base it on, it has to be founded. And I'm perfectly willing to admit, I know, and I'm with absolute certainty, that, you know, I make a lot of mistakes. My judgment is not, you know, it's not soundproof. No, I make mistakes. I could be wrong. Right? I could be right. You have to listen to the argument, decide for yourself. Right, but don't just say because you disagree with it and you haven't really given it thought. There's nothing there.
Are there any alternatives that you suggest for Muslim children?
For school?
For schooling?
I think very small groups of, you know, like a homeschooling effort type within small groups. I think, you know, there's ample evidence, there's an argument about socialization. That schools provide this thing called socialization. I think there's ample evidence to really disprove that. In fact, children actually usually turn out much more humane when they're not exposed to the quote-unquote socialization that goes on in a lot of schools.
I have two questions there. It doesn't just that you neglect the responsibility in order just because
the man may or may not. No, that's a good point. I think that's a very good point. I told one group of women, I said, you know, women have a jihad, and their jihad is men. And that's a hadith. A woman in her house is like a mujahida. She has to put up with not only the children, but the big child a lot of times, right? And she's a mujahida. And so one of these women at this question and answer session asked me, well, why should we do our jihad if the men aren't doing their jihad? And I said, because you don't want to lower yourselves down to their level. I mean, why should you abandon your jihad because the men have abandoned their jihad? No, get your reward with Allah. Really. Get your reward with Allah. Why? So, I mean, that's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned that.
What was the point?
You know, that what I was saying about the fact that men have these double standards, right? That they're in disguise in this culture. Muslims are literally in disguise in this culture. And yet the women are not, they are out, they're out front. You know, you go to the grocery market with a hijab, and that is a statement. I mean, my wife went to this bank, and she was getting her own account, because her money's her money, it's not my money. She was getting her own account, and the teller, the woman said to her,
that's so nice that you're able to do this. Really? You know, she's looking at this hijab and, wow, you can get your own account. Well, what's he going to do next? Let you drive a car? Right? See, because that's the way a lot of these people think. They just think that automatically it's, I mean, the best ones are these, you know, Muslim women that are like PhDs and doctors with the hijab, because that's just like, you know, wait a second. Huh? You must have got it in Karachi. No, it was Harvard, actually. You know?
My second question was, the
non-person
principle.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could
Okay, good point. Nis is not a necessity in Sharia. And in the old days, most Muslims used to eat meat if they were wealthy, middle class, once a week on Friday. And if they were poor, on the Eids. Why do you think we sacrifice on the Eid? It's to give people that all year have not had meat. So traditionally the Muslims were literally semi-vegetarian. The Prophet was, I mean technically, the Prophet would go under that category. He was not a meat eater. Most of his meals did not have meat in them. And the proof of that is clearly in the Muwatta when Sayyidina Umar says, beware of meat, because it has an addiction like the addiction of wine. And the other hadith, in the Muwatta, there's a chapter called Bab al-Lahm, the chapter of Lahm, chapter of meat. Both are from Sayyidina Umar. And Umar, during his khilafah, prohibited people from eating meat 2 days in a row. He only allowed them to eat every other day, and the Khalifa has that right to do that. He did not let people eat meat every day, and he saw one man eating meat every day in the Muwatta, and he said to him, every time you get hungry, you go out and buy meat. Right? In other words, every time your nafs wants meat, you go out and buy it. And the man said, Ya Amir al-Mu'min, Ana Qarim, which in Arabic, Qarim means I love meat. You know, he's a carnivore. He loves meat. And Sayyidina Umar said that it would be better for you to roll up your tummy a little bit so that other people can eat. Now Umar, if there was a prophet, after the Prophet, it would have been Umar. And that is really verging on prophecy, that statement. Because if you study modern meat industry, you will find out that a lot of the famine in the world is a direct result of the overconsumption of meat in countries like the United States and Canada and Europe. Because the amount of grain that is needed to produce 1 pound of meat, right, is much greater than the amount that you need to produce grain itself. So, and beef in particular, I mean, I really recommend Rifkin's book Beyond Beef, because I mean, it's an extraordinary book, you know. It's interesting, Baqarah is also, you know, chapter of the Quran, kill the cow. Because beef eating societies are, you know, just have massive impact on the environment, on natural resources, on all these things. And traditionally the Muslims were not cow eaters. They were sheep and lamb when they did eat meat. Which, I mean, meat is not, cow meat is not, you know, it's not haram, it's not makruh. So I'm not saying that. But
what was the author?
Jeremy Rifkin. It's called Beyond Beef.
I'm wondering what Rifkin says about the argument that particularly in high school situations or sometimes on the job that Muslims are interacting and are forced to interact with people of the other gender. And then when they come into Muslim circles, they have no interaction with people of the other gender. And that maybe there would be some benefit for Muslims in Muslim circles to have respectful interaction, because otherwise, particularly in the high school situation, they start dating non-Muslims.
Right.
Because that's who they learn, that's who they get to know.
Right. This is a big problem in this country, and it's a major problem. The delaying of marriage is a problem by Sharia, because it's better for young people to marry early. Sayyidina Ali was 17, Fatima was 15 when they married. And that's really when you have serious problems. That is the real period of trouble, is that what they call here kind of an adolescent period. In more traditional cultures, people begin to act like adults at about
11, 12. Really, they do. I mean, it's quite interesting to meet a 12-year-old Mauritanian boy as opposed to a 12-year-old American boy. There's an incredible difference in the intellect and maturity. So that's a problem. In terms of what's called ikhtilaf, there's really nothing in Sharia about ikhtilaf. It's not a traditional word, it's not a word, and that's the word modern Arabs use for mixture of male and female. The first community, I find it really hard to believe that they were as obsessive about these matters as some modern type of Muslims. Personally, just from my own reading and things like that, I think there's a basic adab that's expected. You'll get into some differences of opinion, like in the Maliki school, the face of a woman is not considered a part of her awra, her nakedness. So it's not prohibited for a man. It only doesn't look upon her with lust to see her face or her hands by Sharia. Now there's other opinions that the face of a woman, particularly a young woman, it's that a man should not look at. And the ayah in the Quran, قُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ يَغُضُّوا مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِمْ, tell the believing men to lower their gaze. There's some, you know, difference of opinion about that. The Malikis understood it to mean one way. Some, Fakhruddin al-Razi mentions the min there is for tab'id. It's for lowering the gaze, not completely, like looking down like this, but not contemplating her mahasin, her zina, not looking upon her lustfully, things like that. So you're going to get differences of opinion that are related to cultures. And the ulama talk about when times get corrupt, there it's preferable to be more strict, to interpret things on a more strict, because you have a lot of just bad people. And unfortunately, in a lot of the Muslim countries, the behavior of the men is quite frightening. I mean, Abdahai, you know, you were just recently in a country, in Latifa, in a country, you know, where the men's behavior is shameful on the streets. Shameless. You know, the gobbling of women, shameless, thank you, is a shameless behavior on the streets, the gobbling of women. I mean, even in some of the quote-unquote strictest Muslim countries, you're shocked at the type of accosting that goes on to some of the women. And I have personal friends, Americans that have lived, who became Muslim, and these women went with their husbands, and they're shocked because these things don't happen to them in this country. You know, really? And these come from Muslim men. Now, I really think, this is facade. I mean, this is corruption. This is the facade. The society has become corrupt. And at that point, women, you know, we need to protect our women from that type of abuse, because that is by Sharia, that is abuse. In fact, the ayah in the Quran about the hijab is in order that you are not abused, not accosted. It's a protective measure against those type of people. Now, in the Muwatta of Imam Malik, and if you don't think Imam Malik is from the Salaf, right, then who's from the Salaf? Because he's from the Qurun al-Mushahada bil-Khayr, from those periods of time that the Prophet testified to their uprightness, and he was from the most virtuous of those people by the consensus of the Ummah. In the Muwatta, he was asked about, what do you think about a man, can his wife sit with his company and eat with them? And Imam Malik said, I don't see any harm in it if they're correct, if there's adab. They don't become frivolous, there's not, you know, improper intimacy, there's not, right? And a woman can come in to the gathering and do these things according to Imam Malik radiallahu anhu, as long as there's some basic adab done. So, you know, I think you beware of extremes, you know? I mean, Imam Bosaidi says, beware of the two extremes of satiety and hunger. And then he says, and maybe hunger in many cases is worse than satiety. In other words, to go to the extreme of deprivation is often worse than going to the extreme of overindulgence. So if we become too Puritan, right, this is what happened in this country. They became Puritans. And boom, now look at the country. Gone to the complete opposite. Muslims are balanced. We're the middle people. You know, if you have too much, if you have this type of Puritanism in a culture, what happens is it goes to the opposite. And people become, so in our quote-unquote most Puritan of countries, pornography is a major problem. The accosting of women is a major problem. Rape is a major problem. I mean, this is a reality. You see? So Muslims traditionally, very balanced cultures and balanced societies. And, you know, I've been in cultures where they're very Muslim and there is interaction between the men and the women and they don't have these social problems. But it's done with adab. It's done. It's not, there's not a, like a complete, you know, oh, how you doing? And, you know, this, no, it's done with adab and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Another question I have very principally, for example, like, I mean, it's difficult to go to school, and so in college, rather, some people take out loans, and they say that because it's a necessity in society, to do that, is that
well, Donna, what do you think? You know, people take out usury loans to go to college. Right, is that permissible? It's not according to what I was taught, and I don't know, maybe there's 1-800 fatwa and you get all kinds of answers, but again, college is not a necessity, nor is making a lot of money. You know, in Sharia, necessity is literally when you're one of these five things is endangered. That is necessity. If you want to understand necessity, when prohibited things are permissible, mashaqqa tajlibat taysir is not to that extreme. There's another qa'ida which says al-darurat tubih al-mahmurat. This is not the same principle here. A car or a home. As far as I know, a car is not a necessity. That renting is, you can rent. A house is not a necessity. In America, a car, Allah Ta'ala. I mean, I think that there might be a case for people in terms of livelihood, being able to support their family and things like that. Allah Ta'ala, I don't know. So I'm just going to say I don't know about that.
You can get
it. I really don't. I don't know. Muslim, it's mustahab to learn how to read the Quran. After Fatiha and one surah, memorized it by heart, it's mustahab, it's not a wajib to learn how to read Arabic.
What about iqra?
Well, iqra means recite. That's the primary meaning of iqra. The vast majority of sahaba were illiterate. The Prophet said, "Inna ummatun umiyya," we're an illiterate people. La naktubu wa la nahsubu. I mean, reading is encouraged very strongly. And it is a fard kifaya that there are people in the community that learn grammar, learn these things, no doubt. And it's highly encouraged, but you can't say it's a wajib. In other words, an illiterate person is not in a wrong action. They don't have to make tawbah from being illiterate if they learn their fard ayn through oral teaching, which is traditionally how much of the teaching in Islam was done. Many women, very righteous women historically, did not know how to read or write. But they knew their fard ayn and things like that historically.
University or college, is it true to seek knowledge?
Okay, seek knowledge in that, whenever you see knowledge, alif lam, seek knowledge, al-ilm, it is talking about sharia knowledge. Now that includes fard kifaya. In other words, there has to be enough people learning the kifaya sciences, so they're, that seeking medicine, there has to be a group within the community that is fulfilling these obligations, but not everybody.
So is it the community's responsibility to ensure the conditions in order for them to get education, or is it allowed to take out loans to provide that service to the community?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know too many people that are going to university now to fulfill a fard kifaya. And the proof is they don't know their fard ayn. And you cannot seek a fard kifaya until you learn your fard ayn. Right? So they're just fooling, deluding themselves. Right? And to give you an example, in the Bay Area, there's one doctor to about every 100 people. In Mauritania, there's one doctor to every 10,000 people. So, a Muslim going to California to practice medicine, he's not fulfilling a fard kifaya, believe you me.
Number three, does the point of difficulty depend on individual or is it determined by...
No, there's rules. I mean, this is... The mashaqqa is clear when there's undue duress. And in certain situations we know, like if you're traveling and you're finding it difficult to fast, then you can break your fast.
Some people could handle different levels of certain kind.
And it would be on at the individual level. Absolutely, that's a good point. It would be based on an individual. Some people can endure things that other people can't. I mean, to give an example, Sheikh Khatri, when he was here, he had an eye operation. The physician wanted to give him anesthesia. He refused it. And he's a Bedouin from, they're tough. You know, he's an older man. He said, I don't want anything that affects my intellect. And he asked the doctor, is it going to affect my intellect? He said, yes, but it's going to hurt. He said, I can stand the pain. I don't want something. I'd rather bear the pain than have my intellect affected. So they actually did a cataract surgery without him having, and the doctor was amazed. That, you know, he was amazed that he did, but I mean, I lived with those people. You know, I saw a man, this really heavy camel load had stepped right on his foot and just walked, and he just, like that, just kept walking. It's like, yeah. What's that? No, the doctor gave him a choice. He said, you don't have to do this, but I'm highly recommending it. Yeah, had he told him, I will not do the surgery unless you do this, then he, and even Sheikh Khatri said, I don't mind going blind because blindness is a kafara for wrong actions. So he said, I don't mind. If I go blind, that's Allah is purifying me of wrong actions. He said, in fact, he was worried about getting his eyesight back from the cataract surgery and the lens replacement. Because he said, you know, he realized the cataract, it's like kafara. And so he's kind of, you know, that's a level of taqwa in Muslim. The Prophet said to Dawis, you know, use medicine, it's not a good thing. Now, the next one, the fourth, is called harm is removed. Al-darab yuzad. Harm is removed. Now, this is a really important. To give you an example, it is prohibited for us to expose our nakedness. But if there is a reason, because out of fear of harm or actual harm that's present, then we can expose our nakedness to a physician, for instance. So if we find like a lump, you know, if a woman finds a lump in her breast or has pain, she can go to a physician and expose that. Now, if it was a Muslim woman, then that's still all right because the breast is not naked for her, right? But if it was a non-Muslim physician, there was no Muslim physician in that area, then this is an example of a darar yuzad, right? That you have to get rid of harm. So it's permissible to do things that in order to remove harm from people.
Is it different between a Muslim woman and non-Muslim woman as far as nakedness?
The nakedness of a Muslim woman to a non-Muslim woman is the same as her nakedness to a non-Muslim, to a man. Yeah. Her nakedness to a sister is the nakedness of a man to other men. Between the surra and the rukla. I think it's the same in Shafi'i. Yeah. A Muslim woman should wear her hijab in the presence of non-Muslim women. Yeah, she should not,
except if it's a family. Family is alright. Non-Muslim family.
What do you say to it?
The same
intention. I mean, it has the same hukum. Hukum doesn't change.
Yeah, because you meant the Muslim.
Yeah.
So
it's the same.
It's the same hukum. And there's a difference. Islam makes a very strong separation between kufr and iman. It's a barrier that's put up. Hijab means barrier. That's what it means. It's a barrier.
None of my family is Muslim, and I live with my sister. So it would be a difficult thing to always at least
living. Let's wait until Sheikh Abdullah comes tomorrow. Okay, to do that. Because I don't like giving Sharia opinions. Too much responsibility. I'm not copying out. I just really, I don't feel qualified to do it. And then norms are binding is the fifth one. In other words, the Sharia recognizes norms within a society, what's called urf and ada. And for instance, if it's an urf in a culture, to say, for instance, the way they divorce would be like a word that maybe the Sharia doesn't mention in the books, but that's the norm in that culture. Like to say, you're free. Right? Anti harra. And that's the way they say you're divorced, then that's binding. You can't say, I didn't say anti taliq. Right? He used a local customary practice, and that is binding if...
So if you say it in English, it's...
Even if it's in English.
Right.
You know? Like here, it's, we're through. Right? In America, we're through. That's it. We're through. Right? That could be binding if that's the intention. You know, this marriage is dissolved. It's over. So, and that's why a qadi has to know the language of a people. He has to know when a qadi comes in, he has to understand the people's psychology. He has to understand their mentality. Imam al-Shafi'i said when he was in Iraq, they had a very, very high level of discourse. And then he went to Egypt. The Egyptians were less sophisticated than the Iraqis, and he said, I had to take my, he said, I went down and down to explain things more clearly to them. Because in Iraq, he was talking at a level, the Iraqis were very sophisticated, cultured people. When he went to Egypt, they were, more simple. He's not saying there's anything wrong with that.
You say that we can wait till Sheikh Abdullah, who does not understand this culture, comes here.
No, he knows it very well. He's lived here. In fact, 4 years is the time.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Sheikh Abdullah from Mauritania.
No, I'm gonna tell him all about it.
Oh.
But like Sheikh Abdullah, if you live in a place 4 years, right? Isn't it 4 years? Nisba. Sheikh Abdullah used to be al Ahsa'i, right? Means he's from al Ahsa. Now he's al Portlandi. Because he lived in Portland first.
It's where you got the train.
That's what Imam means. No, you start there, you see order if there is a conflict.
I mean, each one of them have different qualities. There is something related to what's called darurat, hajiyat, and tahsinat. And that is how things are categorized. There are things called necessities, and those are things in which the five kulliyat are jeopardized. And in that position, that's always above hajiyat. So for instance, food is a necessity, and that's why it's permitted to eat pork if you're dying of hunger. Because pork is from the, it's from is pork a haji, is from hajiyat? Sheikh Abdullah. Is pork prohibited from tahsinat? It's tahsinat, isn't it? Because it's qadirat.
Or
pork. It's tahsinat. Pork is from the third category, from tahsinat. Like najasa is from tahsinat. Which are those, I mean, if you look at the way I was taught, with the people I studied usul with, they said that the darurat are like the shelter. It's a necessity to have shelter. And the hajiyat are like the doors and the windows. And then the tahsinat are like the furniture in the house.
Is it numbers here? That's what you said?
No. This is related to categorizing things of level of importance. In medical language, you'd call it triaging. In other words, like in an intensive care unit, if somebody comes in, his head's chopped off, and then there's a person next to him that's saying, I've got a really bad headache, you deal with the guy with his hand chopped off. You don't worry about the headache until, right? Oh, no, headache. Hand chopped off. Yeah, this hand chopped off, you deal with the headache. So, what time is it?
About 1.
8 Yeah, the 5. Yeah, the 5. The deen, nafs, I explained that to him. The darurat are related to if they will jeopardize any of those 5 things. That moves into darurat. And the hadiyat are those things that are
make you live.
Yeah, it would be undue duress. And then the tahsinat, it makes life it's just not enriched. Anything else? Hamza, inshallah, wants to make shahada because he's never done this officially. So alhamdulillah. And this is mashallah Abdahai's son. And so we'll just bismillah, we'll say the shahada inshallah. Just repeat after me. We know the shahada, so repeat after me. I know he knows everything, so he's doing this, you know, based on knowledge, and so I don't have to go over five pillars or anything like that. So just say in presence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as our witness, and then the Muslim community, ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna muhammadan rasulullah ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna muhammadan rasulullah ashhadu أن لا إله إلا الله وأشهد أن محمدا رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم. الحمد لله. That's, you know, it's a big thing. Shahada, great thing. It's a big thing.